Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Sina Bazilecki. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Mark Dunley's conversation with Nick Mottern about killer drones. Then we have another segment of Reclaiming History. Livonia Mallory interviews Joan Wagner of Dudley Observatory. Later on, Paul Smart reports on the South Pearl Street's old McDonald's renovation into a food market for Albany's South End. After that, we talk with HMM producer Eileen Javier about how working with this radio program allows her to open doors for others. Finally, Troy Prep Media Club member Treasure Irvin speaks with Akiva Benbow, a DJ and activist with Troy for Black Lives. But first, here are the headlines. On Thursday night, Troy residents urged City Council not to hire 6 community police officers, but to instead invest money in meeting city needs for additional social services, recreation, and programs to battle systemic racism. The Times Union reports that after nearly 5 hours of comments by residents and activists and debate by lawmakers, the City Council decided after a 5-2 vote to expand the police force and transfer $182,731 to pay for the new officers to go through the upcoming Zone 5 Police Academy session. The Times Union also reports that 2 Albany high school students were selected to take part in a prestigious fellowship program started by former President Barack Obama. Juniors Gideon Goldman and Marcus Treese will participate in the rigorous 10-month leadership training program through the New York State Department of Education, My Brother's Keepers Initiative, which is now in its 4th year.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WOOA LP 106.9 FM in Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM in Albany. But we're coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary Sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org or email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. or call us at 518-272-2390. First up today is a conversation about drones. Mark Dunley talks with Nick Mottern about Ban Killer Drones, a new campaign for a international treaty to ban weaponized drones and for military and police drone surveillance.
We're talking with Nick Mottern, who is the coordinator of a new campaign, but certainly not a new issue, Ban Killer Drones, which is seeking an international treaty to ban weaponized drones and also to stop military and police use of drone use for surveillance. So Nick, why have you launched a campaign at this point?
Well, first, thanks very much, Mark, for talking with me about this. I'm working right now with Kathy Kelly, who has a long experience of peace activities. Brian Terrell, who's the same. Both of them have been gone to federal prison over drone protests. David Swanson from World Beyond Wars, very much a part of this. A woman named Chelsea Ferry up in Northampton, Mass., who was on the Code Pink delegation in 2012 to Pakistan to protest U.S. drone attacks in the federal lands there. And we've all come to the conclusion that after 20 years of drone warfare, not only on the part of the U.S., but Israel, Turkey has been involved to a certain degree, other, you know, smaller countries. It's really time to just determine and to say and to rule that these weapons are too dangerous. The damage is too indiscriminate. They have to be put back in the box in the same way that there have been treaties to ban the use of landmines, cluster bombs, poison gas, and that the way things are developing with drones, in other words, the drones have been used largely as a weapon to enforce colonial relationships. Wealthy countries, particularly the United States, overwhelmingly has used drones in parts of the world where it wants to have control of oil, minerals, other resources. The notion of fighting terrorism has been used to justify that, but that's how they've been used. And we're at a point where these relatively primitive drones are evolving into combat heavy drone air, you know, weaponized bombers, fighters, whatever, drones that will be used between the imperial powers of the world, the US, the Chinese, perhaps the Russians, to carry us into a whole other level of killing by machine, and then the machines will kill people, obviously.
So let me jump in here.
Yeah.
You mentioned previously that this has been a 20-year growth period for the use of drones. That means it's been both a Democrat, Republican, a bipartisan effort. And in fact, it's well known that President Obama dramatically expanded the use of drones when he took him, I believe, particularly in Pakistan. Where is President Biden on the use and expansion of drones?
Well, as far as we can tell, he's on the same track Obama was on. At the same time, he says that he is going to remove U.S. ground troops from Afghanistan by September 11th. He also says that, or his people have told reporters, that don't worry, we're going to use drones and other aircraft to oversee, overwatch, and if necessary, attack in Afghanistan, even though we don't have boots on the ground. And so these articles, New York Times and other places, Washington Post, have said that we're looking for bases in Azerbaijan, Tajikistan, possibly even flying from Gulf, you know, states, so that we can continue to maintain that kind of violent pressure in Afghanistan, along with some special forces, commandos, whatever they want to call them, on the ground, who will be essentially assassination corps, much like the Phoenix program and was the United States and CIA ran in Vietnam.
Now, the United States certainly has gotten a lot of, you know, bad publicity because they have routinely misfired with the drones and often have killed civilians. Has there been any success in courts in holding the United States and other countries you know, criminally responsible for, you know, some of the damage they have done with the use of drones?
No, not really. REPRIEVE is a legal institution to protect human rights, and they have tried to do prosecutions on the behalf of drone victims. I think there have been some small amount of reparations, but there's nothing been done in court or in the United Nations to put a stop to drone attacks. And one thing that we're arguing, and I think it's very important, to talk about the harm to civilian populations that's unacceptable. If let's say that in our community here, and I live in a little town, Hastings on Hudson, on Hudson River, if a drone would come and kill someone in our town who was actually a murderer themselves, now some people might be very pleased about that, but other people would be terrified that something from the sky, but coming from the government, could reach into our town and kill people. If more people were killed, so quote, accidentally, unquote, then people would be afraid to even leave their homes for fear that if they were seen, you know, in a congregation of several people, they might also be targets. This is what's happened in these other countries. So it's not only a violation of law and morality to undertake assassination anywhere you want, anytime you want. That's against international law. It's against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But it's also against the law to undertake attacks that have indiscriminate harm to civilians, quote unquote. And so no matter whether the drone kills one or two people or more people, it still brings terror and trauma to people in a very unpredictable and widespread way.
Nick, we're beginning to run out of time, so let me finish with a two-part question. You have about 90 seconds to answer. One, you also addressed the expanded use of drones for military and police surveillance. How much is that actually occurring? And then second, on the international effort, you know, how are other countries reacting to the concept of doing this treaty? Get 90 seconds.
Right now, the police forces are picking up on drone technology across the U.S. You know, it's very popular, and it's happening in other countries as well. As far as how other countries are reacting to what we're proposing, we haven't really gotten into it with any public officials from those countries, but we have been in touch with civilians in other countries, Germany, Italy, France, who are very favorable to what we're doing.
Okay. We've been talking to Nick Matern, who is the campaign coordinator of Ban Killer Drones. You have a website that people can check it out?
Yes, www.ban, B-A-N, killer drones, drones.org, Ban Killer Drones.
And should people contact their congressman, Biden? What can they do in 10 seconds?
Yes, they can write to their member of Congress, read the website, write to their member of Congress. We're also writing letters, especially to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar in Minnesota, because I think she's the one most likely to want to go along with banning these weapons.
Okay. Well, thank you, Nick Martin. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Again, if you want to support the banning of killer drones, writing to your congressperson or representative Ilhan Omar is a way to do that.
Up next, we have another segment of Reclaiming History. It's my interview with Joan Wagner of the Dudley Observatory. She is responsible for the educational initiatives at the observation. She has an extensive experience as a teacher and an educator. She went to the University of Syracuse, where she got a BA in biology and psychology, the Teacher College, Columbia University with an MA in science education, and a fellowship in molecular biology at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute postgraduate course. She's worked at HOSPA University and at the University of Albany, St. Rose, and Union. Stay tuned. Thank you, Mrs. Wagner, for joining us on another segment of Reclaiming History.
You're primarily responsible for the Education Committee.
Yes, for all of our outreach. A lot of it had to do with teachers, to train teachers in astronomy, which was a lot of fun to do. We ran a was a one-week institute, 8 hours a day. We brought in various types of lecturers. There was all sorts of activities that the teachers went through. And so it's always good if you're going to do an activity or a laboratory in classroom to experience it yourself to see what types of issues come up. And therefore, when you actually are teaching it in a classroom, it goes much more smoothly. So, as I said, we did that for 5 years, and actually it was continued during the summer with our last astronomer at Dudley, too. And I came in to just talk a little bit about the pedagogy that would be useful in teaching astronomy.
So how long have you been with Dudley Observatory?
Oh, I was trying to think, how long have I been? I think I joined the Dudley in 2006. I was actually brought there by the president of Dudley because I also run a regional international science and engineering fair, and the late Sam Waite from RPI was president then of the Dudley Observatory, and so I knew him through RPI, and he asked me to join the organization and bring in my education background, since they do a lot of, that's the main focus of Dudley. It used to be for research, but now it's really an astronomy outreach organization.
So for someone who's been around that long, you must do it because you love it. I can't imagine you'd stay doing what you do if you didn't really love it.
I love science education. I'm involved in various aspects. I taught science for 34 years.
Science teacher.
Yeah. So I was in the classroom a long time. I taught on Long Island, Freeport High School, for a while. And then when we moved upstate, I taught at Burn Hills, Ballston Lake, both the high school and the middle school. And then I even taught a summer course for talented students, actually, in DNA science and technology at the University at Albany. So the astronomy part was, I was actually brought in because not of my great background in astronomy, because of my education background.
So you used one of those educational words earlier, pedagogy.
Yes.
What exactly does that mean to us laymen, non-educational folks?
There's strategies in how to engage students in teaching to get kids excited about learning. So there's all sorts of different strategies that are effective, certainly, for example, when you're doing projects, because there's different learning styles for students. You give them different ways to be successful. Some might be artists. So, for example, when we were studying atomic structure, some kids made mobiles. Some kids wrote reports about atoms. Some kids even wrote poetry about atoms. Different ways in which they can use their own talents and still be successful in the classroom. So pedagogy is different ways of encouraging students to learn science, different ways of presenting material. For example, when I was teaching at Burn Hills, I taught a number of different sciences. So when I taught physics, chemistry, physical science for middle school, I used to run a magic show. And I do all sorts of demonstrations. And I never tell them why something happened, but they became very inquisitive about what is going on. And through that, then I bring out the demonstrations I did when I actually was going to teach a topic related to the demonstrations. I bring out the demonstration again, and the students will say, oh, I remember the drinking bird, for example. And so they finally figured out how it actually works, that it wasn't really magic, it was science.
Great. So to my listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is another segment of Reclaiming History with Livonia Mallory, airing on WOOC 105.3 FM, the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And I have Miss Wagner on the line with me. Being an experienced teacher, she works at the Dudley Observatory. So Miss Wagner, when you think about all of the great work that Dudley does every day, day after day, What are you most proud of?
I think the programs that we're able to present to the public, particularly our last astronomer, Valerie Rapson, did a wonderful job of outreach. So we have the Rising Star program for students where they are given telescopes and they wow. learn how to use the telescopes and obviously learn how to navigate the night sky, sort of like a map info type of way of doing things, learning. It's a GPS of the night sky, learning where bodies are located, stars and planets, and sometimes you even see a meteor shower, which is exciting.
One of the things, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you folks over at the Dudley was because there are so many women involved in the Dudley Observatory, so many women at every level. Do you think that that makes a difference when you have so many women involved in science?
Oh, absolutely. The research has shown that children learn best when people are more similar to them. And that not only goes for the sex of the person, but even the ethnic or racial groups of people, they learn better when people are more like them. And so girls, you set by example. For example, when I was teaching biology and we were doing some dissections, and the kids go, ooh, disgusting, when they see frogs and formaldehyde or formalin, what's what we actually use. Formaldehyde was considered pretty bad, although formalin's not all that great either. And I'd stick my hands in and grab out a frog, and they go, oh, she did it, so maybe I can. Or I used to keep a lot of live animals in the classroom. I'd pick up a snake, and they go, I had a Bessie, or a boa constrictor. And the kids got used to hanging out with Bessie. She'd wrap around their necks and or on their waist, and they weren't afraid of these animals. And snakes are not slimy, as some people always thought. So just seeing a woman in that role, and certainly because of the number of years and how old I am at this point, when I was in school, a lot of women were not majoring in science. And because of my background's more in biology, I took a lot of pre-med courses, and of course my courses back then were mostly men, and I was often the subject of lots of pranks, particularly in a laboratory, because I was often one or two girls that were in that particular laboratory. So we've come a long way. Actually, women, there's more women applying to medical school now than men or in medical school at this point. However, the areas of astronomy and physics, there's still less women that are in there. And actually, the whole history of Dudley, if you go into it, everybody who's seen the movie Hidden Figures about these women who did all the math for NASA, well, the same thing was true with observatories. The Harvard Observatory and the Dudley Observatory employed what they called computers, but the computers were women, and they were paid just about nothing. They were often the wives or children or relatives or close friends, and they would do the work where they'd have these glass slides of the night sky that were taken by the men, and they were asked to do all the measurements, and they would measure distances. But a lot of these women began to even classify stars. They really advanced astronomy tremendously and were never really recognized for their work. So the term computers actually goes back to the women who were actually doing all the computing before, and then they became the programmers for the computers, still doing the tedious work.
Well, Ms. Wagner, we are so grateful that you joined us on another segment of Reclaiming History. To my listeners, give them your name and your title and responsibility over at the Dudley.
My name is Joan Wagner. I chair the Science Education Committee, and I also am the secretary, so I get to take all the notes during our board meetings.
Excellent. Ms. Wagner, is there anything else that we haven't had a chance to talk about that you want to make sure that we share and discuss with my listeners?
Well, a number of times a month, we do have an outside meeting at the Octagon Barn. A lot of the students who are in the Rising Star program bring their telescopes, and a lot of local people get to view the night sky. So it's very exciting. And they often bring a lecturer there, too. So right now, it's been virtual.
And what day of the week does the Octagon Barn occur?
It usually takes place on a Friday night.
And at what time, approximately?
Sundown.
Okay. So that's Friday evening, sundown, at the Octagon Barn. Ms. Joan Wagner, thank you for joining me on another segment of Reclaiming History with Livonia Mallory.
Reclaiming History is a regular segment on Hudson Mohawk Magazine by Livonia Mallory. You just heard her speaking with Joan Wagner of Dudley Observatory.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. Up next, Trayvon Jackson of the African American Cultural Center announces his organization's purchase of the old McDonald's on South Pearl Street for renovations into a much-needed food market for Albany's South End. It will be managed by the existing South Pearl store, LP Lone, reporting by Paul Smart.
At this week's South End Community Collaborative meeting held on Zoom on Tuesday, Trayvon Jackson of the African American Cultural Center and the company Blue Light spoke about the recent sale of the South Pearl McDonald's for conversion into a neighborhood food market.
Yes, I'm very excited to report that the African American Cultural Center, in collaboration with the County of Albany, the Downtown Albany Business Improvement District, and Blue Light Development Group, have come together to purchase the former McDonald's building for the purpose of opening an expanded grocery store. We have also consulted with LP Lone Grocery, which, for those who aren't familiar, is located right down the street from the Cultural Center. They serve hot foods. They have a limited grocery selection. They primarily service construction and trade workers and their hot lunches during the day, as well as state workers who come down to the neighborhood and neighborhood residents with groceries, EBT eligible purchases, and other culturally competent foods. So our plan is a tentative close in July with a rough opening scheduled for September. In terms of the building, the biggest need for it is a new roof. Which, all things considered, I'll take over a lot of the other improvements that might have been needed. And overall, the site, as many of you know, is very well suited to that kind of project. There is a ton of parking. The site is generous. And it's our intention to have community groups come together and program that space similar to how the African American Cultural Center has operated. So discussions about open air farmers markets, partnering with A Village to expand the summer market further down South Pearl, as well as provide additional space. In addition to just coordinating with all of the other partners we worked with in the neighborhood, you know, Raddatz Center, Free School, South End Improvement Corp, and others, and finding ways that really we can make an impact together. I think leveraging the resources in this group, particularly for the programming and occupation, is going to be key. I've told a couple of other folks separately, I think the hardest part of this initiative over the years we've been working on it, discussing it, as well as the decades that it's been wanted and called for in the community, is putting a deal together for a site. You know, the negotiation, the transaction, putting a contract together, and, you know, candidly doing a lot of that work for free while you're doing pre-dev, and just getting something together that people can react to and be ready to work on. So that work is done. We're very thankful for the work and collaboration of Albany Housing as we negotiated and tried to come to terms that made sense. And I'd also like to commend Albany Housing for being restrictive in their sale. They made it very clear from the beginning that they were not interested in selling the property to someone who didn't have awareness of either the grocery issue or other commercial environmental issues as it relates to underground tank storage and other DEC issues, et cetera. So we're very excited and happy. I think the main takeaway for me with all of you is that we are a partnership organization, as the Cultural Center and others have been in the past. And it's my hope that as many of you as possible will join us in the effort to not just locate a grocery store at the location, but make it a hub for community outreach, public health initiatives, as well as deeper collaboration among all of our groups. This will be a community resource. And I, working with David in the past, I know he has a lot of great legwork already moved ahead in terms of community ownership models, community trust, and other ways that the community can be engaged. And I know we all have heard feedback from the community about how badly they want this. So I really want to integrate and move that momentum forward and provide an opportunity for everyone to work and collaborate together. So
just to understand the structure a little bit more. So who So is it Blue Light that's purchasing the property? Like, who's actually going to be purchasing the property and have it under title?
The African American Cultural Center. Okay. Yeah, Blue Light is serving as development consultant and grant making agency. And we're also providing in-kind development support to the project. The county has been very engaged across a couple of different departments in the conversation about mortgage and recording tax, as well as property tax and pilot agreements. So you're spot on the money there. I know that having discussions with Sam, Ms. Willingham, Mr. Clay, the IDA and planning, that's definitely something that's in their purview and they've been supportive of that. So I would invite everyone, as David said, to also participate in that effort. As we talk about sustainability, right, of course, that is a key discussion point. And that's why it was so important for us to look to a local grocer to work with. It was our opinion that finding a grocer that has already survived in the neighborhood for multiple years through the investment, disinvestment, arrival of Dollar General and Family Dollars, and then subsequent exit would be much more sustainable than trying to find either an outside investor who's looking to capture a market or a speculative startup proposal. Right. There's also benefit to working with a local grocer in that they have an understanding of the local supply chain and they have existing relationships with local vendors as well. And that supports local job creation as we expand their business to another site. So that, to your sustainability point, that was what informed our decision to seek out LP Loan for, at a minimum, their expertise and ideally, you know, their full occupation of the site. But we remain flexible to all other initiatives and strategies that make the site more sustainable. That includes the African American Cultural Center providing accommodative rents to the grocer that moves into the site and allowing them to invest what would be rent proceeds directly into capital and equipment improvements for their business. So all of those things are also underway in planning from a programmatic standpoint. All of us coming together, ultimately, despite whatever questions or concerns we may have, is going to be the key here. I think the key here is going to be coming together as a group to identify any potential blind spots and offer support. Because the overwhelming point here that I hear from everyone is we all want this. And we have ways and means that we've all tried before. So I really do hope, in the spirit of David's comments, that we can join together as a team. And anywhere someone finds a gap, they can stand in and fill that and join as a partner. And we can all stand together.
Yes, I wanted to know if this would be an organic grocery or a general grocery store.
Great question. So there would be organic options provided. Primarily, it would be what a lot of us refer to as either a culturally competent store or an international store, and that it derives from a specific heritage, in this case, Dominican. So when you talk about organic foods, vegan foods, they currently offer those at their location at 179 South Pearl. So you're talking your bacalao, your vegetables, your vegan empanadas, things that are fried without egg, et cetera. The difficulty is just that it's such a small operation down there. They can't achieve the scale necessary to really serve the people in a quantity that moves the needle, right? It's sustainable enough for them to keep it on the shelves, but not for them to really reach the target population. So this expansion would expand that part of the business. I mean, there's Rooted right down the street that's healthy, wellness, and living. We have plenty of people who come to this area for exercise, as well as just outdoor green space and walking. So it will be organic. There will be vegetarian and vegan options offered as well. And that'll be an expansion of their current work in their location. Oh, and then quick question I saw, how large in square feet is the building? So the building itself is 3,148 square feet, which, you know, for anyone who's ever been in a bodega or a convenience store is like the largest bodega ever. Right. I mean, this side north of the Bronx or Harlem, maybe. Right. So it's a much bigger location. It's at least double in some change of what they have right now. And I'd also point out to folks, you know, we discovered this doing our walkthroughs. It seems like no one has ever been behind the counter of a McDonald's, right? Like in their life. So when we all actually went behind the counter, it is surprisingly large in that building. The kitchen space is very substantial. There's a separate IT room. A separate cold storage wing with a walk-in freezer and refrigerator for cold storage, as well as the three drive-in windows and additional storage space. So the interior is very spacious. In terms of will it need to be enlarged? Will it need to be? No. It's currently large enough for them to expand in concert with their existing operations and have a very large, meaningful impact on the community. I think the key to that site is the site. So the site itself is about 1.5 acres, which is about 67,000 square feet. So when you talk about parking, when you talk about programming, when you talk about public health initiatives, you have plenty of outdoor space for all of those activities. I think down the line, the conversation with the county and other public agencies is going to be, what way can we all best partner to develop and expand intelligently with thoughtfulness and in a way that the community needs? I think there is a big discussion to be had about having additional green space or a pop-up park on that site, especially as you're entering the neighborhood. There's also been conversation about providing potential drive-in movie amenities to the neighborhood, as well as other things that would be a bit more permanent in structure. And we're open to all of those ideas to make use of that site. And if there are any of those ideas that include at some point expanding the building or building a wholly separate structure in a different place on the site, you know, there is space for that. And that's something we want to continue to explore, because we envision this as a decades long project, and the grocery store is phase one, right? But we've also had the conversation about pharmaceutical needs. So with the drive-in windows in the building, there's also space to look at pharmaceutical access. And if it does get to a point where that need is large enough to demand larger investment, we have space to put either, you know, an urgent care and an inpatient outpatient facility. There's a lot of flexibility, I think, on that site. So Dominic, to your question, it doesn't need to be enlarged to operate the grocery, but I think moving forward, we should be open-minded to adding other sites or other scattered development on that parcel to meet the needs of the community.
This has been Paul Smart for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
You just heard Trayvon Jackson of the African American Cultural Center announcing the renovation of an old McDonald's into a much-needed food market for Albany South End, reported on by Paul Smart.
Eileen Javier is one of the producers at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. HMM's correspondent, Sina Basila Hickey, spoke with Eileen about what drew her to the sanctuary and working in community radio and the topics that are important to her.
I'm speaking with Eileen Javier, one of the producers of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Eileen, I'd love to know, when did you first get involved with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine?
Hi, Sina. So I got involved in the Hudson Mohawk Magazine because I visited the Sanctuary for Independent Media to go watch a documentary called The Infiltrators. It was a documentary about immigrants' families and how they deal with that many years ago. At that moment, at that time, I used to be taking a class to become a community health worker. And I mentioned that to Brenda and to Mel and Kathy High, and they said, oh, we have an initiative coming up, which is the Health Autonomy Clinic. It's now the People Health Sanctuary. And they say you can collaborate with that initiative. And it was like a dream come true, because I was actually looking to do an internship that allowed me to work with the community. And that's how I get involved with the sanctuary and consequently with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
So the work that you do outside of the radio station, there's a lot of overlapping in the subject area. What is your work and how do you bring it to the station?
I am part of a very small grassroots organization that assists immigrants in the community in the Capital Region area. And I also volunteer in Food Pantry, which is also in Troy, Oakwood Community Center. And I am involved in the Troy DSA, helping with housing. So basically, I am involved in different initiatives within the city of Troy that deal with social justice. So the Sanctuary for Independent Media is I don't see it as an organization. I see the Sanctuary more as a movement, because what they do is not only encouraging social justice, but also bringing art as a way to protest and to bring awareness and create change. So I don't know if that answered your question, but basically the sanctuary has all of what I am interested in one space. So I'm super happy to being able to find a place that has it all.
So are some of these themes that you report on, can you talk about what type of themes you bring into your producing?
I am interested in things that can help the community. I mean, one that I remember and smile and make me very happy is I did an interview with Diane Cameron last year. And this was for the healthcare that was recently opening up to the essential workers. And I really loved how she described how the children were taking the situation that we were in, the pandemic, like a game, you know, putting the little mask and washing the little hands. And to me, it was important that the people will understand that it was safe to bring the children. And also the way that she described the entrance and how they will take care. It was a way to, through the radio, to bring this information to the city. So I see radio as the oldest way to communicate, but also to reach out to people that are driving and they are listening to podcasts now, or they can be doing different things, but they have access to that communication that is available to them. And without us producing these pieces, they wouldn't know about all these assets that the community has.
Did you work in audio before?
No, not at all. I'm actually very shy to be speaking about what I do and also to be speaking in public.
And why is that?
Okay. When you speak English as a second language, not everybody is accepting of how one speaks. People tend to see that if you have an accent, you might not be bright and you might not be knowledgeable about things. This is not everybody, but some people tend to do that, and I notice. So therefore, sometimes I don't even use my voice because I didn't see the point. The only way that I speak about something is because I truly care, and then I say, okay, I will do it. But this is why I never really did it. But Brenda Miller, Steve Pierce, Melissa Bromley, and Kathy, hi, said, you can do it, and basically incite the confidence in me to be able to do this.
Absolutely. And for the reasons that you just said, by having your voice on the radio, you're dispelling this misconception that people might have. Do you see it that way?
I think I see it that way. And I think it's as an immigrant, because even though I was born in Puerto Rico, I am the child of two immigrants from Dominican Republic. I think, yes, people should take ownership, and including myself, and be brave and not pay so much attention on how people judge you, but just speak up to be able to let others see, okay, if she can do it, I could do it.
And that is a little bit of the role that you play in your community, isn't it? I mean, your role of working with other groups, I see your work often as dispelling misconceptions about mental illness, immigration, other aspects. So isn't this really a part of your work, is to bring up people and to correct misconceptions?
You put me in the spot, Zina. Yes, I think I am doing that. And it was a little bit unintentionally, but it's happening. And I'm opening doors for other people. I hope it makes sense. So what I'm hoping to do is that whatever I do, I don't know that one person might change the world of many, but if I am able to reach out one person, that person might be able to make a change within their little group. And by that, I create kind of a ripple effect. So that's kind of my vision of what I would like to live my life. So yes, one thing is to be brave and not be thinking about what I can't do and then put myself out there and said, okay, I will do it because I'm making a difference.
So how is audio a powerful medium for this work?
Audio is an excellent medium. It's not only that we bring awareness of the different programs available, but also we discuss books. We bring mental health awareness. Actually, I did a good interview with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And after that, a couple of people asked me for her number and to be in contact with her. And it's all because of a little segment that it was only 10 minutes, but it was powerful. Because back in that time, people were really in need to know that somebody was there because it was during the pandemic.
What do you still want to achieve? Like, where do you hope to go? And what are some last thoughts about the work that you do for Hudson Mohawk Magazine?
Well, first of all, I want to continue being more involved in the radio, but also in the People's Health Sanctuary. I would like to create a space not only for the community, but for immigrants and for kind of expanding what we do to reach out the capital region completely and continue the work that the sanctuary does, educating, bringing social justice, and basically creating something called, it's a philosophy, it's an African philosophy that I believe and I live my life with. This is the philosophy of Ubuntu. I am because we are. A community is as strong as the people that are in it, and we're all together in this. We are able to do a lot if we said, okay, let's put all the discouragements that we have on every self-consciousness on the side and do it.
That was my interview with Eileen Javier. Hudson Mohawk Magazine is a volunteer-run initiative with incredible community producers. If you'd like to join our volunteer effort, please email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. If you'd like to hear the work that Eileen referenced in the interview, please visit our website at mediasanctuary.org.
Troy Prep Media Club member Treasure Urban speaks with Akiva Benbo, a DJ activist with Troy for Black Lives. Benbo reacts to the Chauvin trial and offers his perspective on what's next for the Black Lives Matter movement locally and beyond.
This is Treasure Urban. I am a member of the Troy Prep Media Club. Today, we are speaking with Akiva. Could you introduce yourself? What do you do? What do you do with the Troy for Black Lives?
My name is Akiva. I'm 26. We don't really have roles like in Troy for Black Lives. Like, everybody just does like what's necessary and, like, you know, steps up to the plate. Like, I DJ full time. So, like, most of the time when, like, we have events and we need music, I'll handle the music. But in Troy for Black Lives, there's no, like, roles, there's no hierarchy. Like, we just move as a unit, like, as a team of like equal status amongst all of us. I'm from Troy, I lived in Troy all my life. That's about it. I went to Hudson Valley Community College for some years. At first I was a phys ed major. And then I changed my major to being on a political science track. I've always been into politics and stuff like that. So I was like, let me just do political science.
How did the protests last June make you feel or have an impact on your life?
It definitely made me feel great because, like, I've never seen that many people in Troy for one thing in my life. I've probably never been to an event or anything in my life that had that many people at it at one time. Like, 11,000 people, a lot of professional stadiums, like, can't hold that many people at once. Like, seeing, I was DJing that event and playing, like, I thought, oh, yeah, we'll have enough sound because we had a few speakers. And at first, it didn't seem like it was that many people. And then next, you know, you see groups of people just falling into to the riverfront. And it's like, nah, this is crazy. Then having everybody on the same accord of like Black Lives Matter, or like, you know, we need to stand up against police brutality and police killings and like come together as a Troy or Capital District. It was definitely an amazing feeling and wish I could relive it every day.
It sounds fun. Me personally, I've never been to like a protest or anything, but I would want to experience because it sounds, you know, and it sounds like pretty cool. So like I should experience one day.
Like the point of a protest is to make it seem like make your voice heard. Abolitionists had protests and rallies and stuff like that. And even like during the civil rights period, Martin Luther King, and like, you know, MLK even says to himself, he says riots are the voices of the unheard. So it's like, you know, when the news media and everybody else like that tries to demonize protests or being violent or calling them riots or looters and stuff like that, then that's like, you know, that's the media that's owned by, like, you know, racist organizations or racist rich white men. They like, you know, they try to take away from the movement. And like, you know, as we see in a lot of places, like, you know, when there's violent or riots or stuff like that, a lot of change actually comes from that. Like, you know, protests, like, that doesn't really, like, you know, take people out of their comfort zone a lot of the times. It doesn't really, like, you know, shake stuff up. But like, you know, in Minnesota, like, you know, if Minnesota didn't burn down and those people that weren't out there on the front lines all them days, like, tearing stuff up, I don't think we would get Derek Chauvin to get a guilty verdict. Or even, like, across the nation, I think both are necessary. Violent riots and non-violent protests are necessary. And, like, you're young, so, like, you definitely should come out. There's more to the movement than just the protests. Like, you know, there's the learning events and meeting people, like the smaller events where, like, you know, you get to meet the people that are part of the movement or part of these organizations locally. Definitely come out. Young people always want it everywhere.
Do you think there will be a part two of the protest this June?
I'm not too sure. Like, as of right now, I don't think we've been planning no protest in June. We're like in the heat of the moment again. Like, you know, seeing how Albany had this protest the other day. We've supported them. So like, if there is a part two, I hope, I would like to hope there would be. This is a good question, maybe. And we're having a meeting later, so maybe I can be like, people are wanting the part two. But hopefully there's a part two. And you guys all should be there.
Did you see the news about Derek Chauvin's case? What's your perspective on George Floyd getting justice, long-term impact on this case?
Like, so I didn't watch the trial, but I saw the last day. Like, I didn't want to watch the trial because it would, like, make me upset and, like, angry, because I'm like, we see all this evidence come out that, like, you know, this guy was in the wrong. And like, over and over again, we see like evidence pointing out that these police officers or people are wrong, in the wrong, but they get off at the end. So I guess I was kind of happy seeing him go to get arrested, go to jail, get guilty verdicts on all three charges. But me personally, I don't think that this is justice. Like, I don't think. Like, I feel like justice starts before an act. Like, you know, we've been going through, like I said, slave time since we've been in America, since America's been named America. Like, you know, this stuff like this has been going on. And I'm like, you know, people have been voicing their opinions to try to stop these situations from even happening. So I think, like, one person said, I don't know if you know who he is or anything like that, but Jerry Ford, he runs Team Hero, and he was like, justice would have been if George Floyd was still alive. So, like, you know, like, if he was still here, like, you know, that's justice. We don't want to see, like, justice that shouldn't come after a tragedy. So, I definitely, it's like, I have mixed emotions about the situation. Like I'm like, and like, a lot of times just like the anger is like, is overwhelming or like overlapping the happiness or whatever. And so, like, long term impacts, I definitely think, I guess this is like a step in the right direction for when we talk about accountability. in our communities, we're held accountable every day by law enforcement, whether it's just, you know, a person that sells a little bit of drugs or a person that's trying to make ends meet to help out their family or whatever. We always get accountability. We always end up going into the prison system. And me personally, I don't believe in the prison system. I believe in abolition of the prison system and the criminal justice system. As we know, Black and brown people are filling up prisons while, like, you know, white people do the same crimes and all this other stuff as equal as we do, and aren't seeing the same type of time in jail or even seeing jail at all. So yeah, definitely makes the most sense about the trial.
I actually know Jerry Ford. I actually know him really well. Yeah. And I don't know if you heard about this or not, but there was something on the news. Well, my dad, I think he seen it on Facebook. And there was this girl. She was fighting this one girl. Like, they was fighting, and she had bought a knife. Yeah. And I guess she went to go try to stab the other girl. Yeah. And the mom had called the police. Mm-hmm. And I guess the police shot the girl, all because she had a knife in her hand, yeah, and shot her three times, yeah, right in her chest. And yeah, she died.
Yeah, Makia
Bryant. Girl.
Yeah, Makia Bryant.
Yes. That was really messed up. What do you think needs to happen with police reform or justice reform?
Like I said, like, to my last statement, I believe in abolition. So, like, it's deeper than police reform and justice reform, because, like, you know, with police reform, we'll still see people get killed by police officers. It's just we just might get what a lot of people will call justice in the court system by accountability. And it's like, I want to stop that. Like, I don't want there to be a possibility of another George Floyd or Trayvon Martin getting killed by a neighborhood watch officer, and not even neighborhood watch officer, a neighborhood watch person, and they both get off on all charges. Prisons are supposed to be rehabilitation centers, basically, and they don't rehabilitate anybody. Like, you know, some people do make it out and better themselves, but then there's a lot of people that are, you know, commit offenses again. And it's like, you know, like, basically a lot of the laws that are put in place to stop, like, you know, the growth of ex-cons or like felons after they come out of prison are kind of set up to, like, to have no growth once they get out. Like, you know, police like stations and police departments have gotten reformed, or like through federal and state laws and other places, like, you know, even in Minnesota, like, you know, they've had reform, like, they have a reformed police department and like police, like, looks of policing in places like Seattle and places like that, and like they have their issues. So it's like I think, like, you know, abolition is better, because, like, you know, a lot of people understand that a lot of people in prison system have gone through childhood trauma or some type of trauma throughout their life and need healing more than they need to be locked up in a prison cell.
Thank you for coming to speak with me today.
No problem.
That was Troy Prep Media Club member Treasure Irvin speaking with Akiva Benbow, a DJ and activist with Troy for Black Lives.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, also your engineer. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.